Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. I'm delighted to be speaking on the phone today with Michael J. Scott, author of The Last Scroll. The book delves into unearthing a scroll, revealing the location of the missing autographs of the New Testament. And we're going to chat with Michael about the validity of the New Testament, as well as how Christianity is emerging into the arts. But first, a little about Michael. Michael J. Scott is a Christ-following husband, father, preacher, teacher, poet, playwright, and writer. He is the author of the Jefferson's Road series, The Coppersmith, Spilt Milk, Eye of Darkness, and The Lost Scroll, a Christian action-adventure novel, and that's the one we're talking about today. He enjoys writing, reading, discussing politics, philosophy, religion, teaching, singing, martial arts, freestyle kendo, acting, cooking, and shooting pool. He currently lives with his family near Rochester, New York. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Well, this is going to be an interesting conversation because I think we can get into some good stuff. But before we do, how about telling our listening audience just a brief synopsis of your book, The Lost Scrolls?
Well, The Lost Scrolls tells the story of Dr. Jonathan Monroe. He is a paleographer, which is a gentleman who studies ancient writings. And he's kind of living a quiet life, and he's just maintaining his own thing. He's locked away in his little cubbyhole of an office there at the University of Michigan, and taking his time and living his life. And he finds himself thrust into a world rather suddenly of international criminals who are trying to claim an artifact he doesn't even believe exists. And this artifact is a scroll unearthed in a place known as the Domo tu Bibliou, which is Greek for home of the book. And the legend is that this place, this church, which has been lost to the sands, is actually the repository for the scrolls, the original autographed scrolls of the New Testament. Now, he thinks this is a myth, but the people who are pursuing it think it's real, and he finds himself swept up into the action and chased by gun-toting bandits and mercenaries who are determined to secure this priceless artifact for themselves. And it kind of goes from there.
All right. Well, it sounds like he is going to be having quite an adventure, that is for sure. And you had mentioned the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what your feeling is how reliable is the New Testament?
The New Testament is beyond comparison the most reliable and the most authenticated book of antique literature in existence today. Nothing else comes even close to it. We say that we have the writings of Plato, of Tacitus, of Aristotle. I think many people have read Homer's Iliad when they were in high school. Homer's Iliad rests on the manuscript authority of about 643 manuscripts, and they date within about 500 years of Homer's actual time. So these are copies that are like 500 years after Homer's time. There's 643 manuscripts, and that is considered huge in the archaeological world. The New Testament authority relies on over 5,000 complete manuscripts and over 20,000 fragments of manuscripts, many dating within 100 years of the New Testament, and some even dating to potentially the first century itself. So it is beyond par the most reliable book. We know what the apostles wrote, is what we're saying. And we know that with a high degree of accuracy that nothing else can even come close to.
However, I do question that, and I'm wondering what your response would be. Is this was written in another language, and in there have been translations. Mm-hmm. And from what my understanding is there are different versions of the New Testament, so therefore it's different translations. And so, then it kind of, I question the reliability of the New Testament, even though, you're saying that there are so many documents.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fair question, and it's one that's fairly easily addressed, actually. There are between 5,000 manuscripts and 20,000 fragments of manuscripts, and not all of these are written in Greek. A number of these are translations. of the original, of the 5,000, I believe most of those actually are Greek manuscripts. And the New Testament predominantly was written in Greek, and some of it, of course, in Aramaic, which was the language of Christ. But bear that in mind. You know, we're talking about copies that are made possibly handwritten from the original manuscripts themselves. And the Greek manuscripts themselves, we know what the Greek says. The Greek was written, it was called Koine Greek. It was the language of the marketplace of the day. And that is a dead language, which means it does not continue to evolve. So Koine Greek is very static. So knowing that, you know, the New Testament books were written in Koine Greek, and knowing that we know how to translate Koine Greek today, because we have a lot of manuscripts in Koine Greek, not just the New Testament, but a lot of secular manuscripts, we know what Koine Greek says. And so because these are in there, we know that this was what was written. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yes, yes, okay. Of course. Mm-hmm. So then I kind of, I'm sitting here and listening to you, and so all this stuff is just going in my mind, and then I'm thinking, okay, so then there is the English translations.
Yes.
And then there is let's see, how am I going to put this? You know, there are so many different sects of Christianity, and each one takes something, looks at each translation or, you know, part of the New Testament in a different view. And I guess what really is coming to me is right now, and I just want to bring this up, is the other day I was watching something on TV, and there's a group that believe in sparing the rod and spoiling the child,
okay,
where they're again, and I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about, what program I was watching. Now, they believe that the child should be spanked. Now, others believe that that is just a metaphor, that, you know, if you don't do tough love or if you don't do discipline, then you're going to be spoiling the child. So it's sort of a literal translation there.
Okay, well, we're actually moving away from the question of translation into the realm of interpretation. See, there's two questions at stake here. The first question is, what does the Bible say? At its face value, on the surface of it, what does it say? And then the second question is, what does it mean? And that's a different animal. Now, see, some people like to say, well, the Bible means what it says and says what it means all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's many places where that is true. The Bible is not just one kind of book. It is actually 66 different books that are written by numerous authors. And they come in all different kinds of genres. Some of these are historical, some of these are theological, some of these are poetry, some of these are what are called wisdom literature. There's prophecy, there's apocalypse, there's biography, there's letters, there's epistles. So there's a lot of different kinds of writing within the New Testament. And not all of those kinds of writing are meant to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's a psalm, it's one of my favorite psalms, that says, "The Lord will shelter you under the shadow of his wings." That does not mean that God is a cosmic chicken. Just because it says he has wings, we should not then infer that God is squawking around up somewhere with wings flapping there. It's a metaphor, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible uses similes. It uses metaphors, just like any literature does. But it also says some things quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
The Hebrews, especially, their form of humor was exaggeration. And so they would take something and expand it to the ridiculous degree, and that's what they found to be humorous. And so there may be an element of that even within the proverb, to spare the rod, spoil the child. You know, they don't necessarily mean that you should go around beating your kid.
Yeah.
You know? But at the same time, you know, they're saying there's room in here to apply measured discipline so that your child doesn't grow up unruly and wild. Okay? And so really, you know, what should characterize that is not a rigid interpretation of Scripture, but rather the character of love and the character of the parent in dealing with their child and understanding, I have to be firm in my discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I would interpret that. But again, that's a realm of interpretation, not a question of translation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, it makes sense, definitely. I just want to go away now into what we're really noticing more so is that Christianity is coming more so into a lot of literature, a lot of the arts. You know, it's coming more into many of the TV shows, into films. And I just wondered what your thoughts are on this and why is this happening?
Well, I think it's a... I think it's a kind of a pendulum shift back to where it needed to be. And let me explain it to you this way. When Catholicism ruled in the West, and it was the form of Christianity within the West, the arts, meaning, most of your plays were being written, and there weren't that many in the Dark Ages, of course, but a lot of them, your music and your painting and your sculpture, it all tended to center around very, very heavily biblical themes. Now,
yes.
The Renaissance changed some of that, and some more, man-centered themes came in, but still, the Christian themes imbued the arts. They covered the whole thing. When Martin Luther tacked his theses under the church door in Wittenberg, Germany, in around 1500 or so, they started a firestorm of controversy in breaking away from the Catholic Church, the whole start of the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestants, not just Luther, but especially John Calvin, were very intent on pulling away from anything that resembled Catholic. And one of the things they did is they said, you Catholics are too focused on images, so we're going to say that that's a form of idolatry, and we're just going to focus on the books. So we're just going to be book people, just read the Bible itself and not deal with the images. And the images were there, and the paintings and so forth were there because a lot of people were illiterate. And so the paintings were ways of expressing the truths of the gospel to people who could not read. So that was one of the ways of communicating that. So the arts were used to communicate theology back in the Middle Ages and prior to the Protestant Reformation, and so, to a degree afterwards, but it began to fade.
Mm-hmm.
As the Protestants focused more and more on just being of the Word and less on being of images and pictures or music and so forth, they began to pull away from that. And so what you see then is this gradual shifting away of the arts as the arts became abandoned by the more dominant Protestants within Western Europe. And then, of course, when they came over here to the United States and we invented our own brand of Protestantism with American evangelicalism and the rise of fundamentalism and so forth,
mm-hmm.
there was an even stronger emphasis on just go by the Bible, just the book. That whole Baconian Scottish common sense theory of, it says what it says, it means what it means, really focused people on the Word. So the entire concept of the arts was abandoned. So fiction or not so much music, but fiction, poetry, dancing, plays, artistry, acting and so forth, and painting, all of these things were left out in the cold. And gradually, they turned away from Christianity, and the people in those fields began seeking other themes to address. And the Christians were quite willing to let them go that way, because obviously if you're writing fiction, you're telling lies, therefore you're a liar.
Right.
You know. Or if you're an actor, you're saying lines that aren't real, so you're a liar. And ridiculous notions like that. Over time, the arts turned against Christianity. So we go all the way from Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel to Andre Serrano's Piss Christ, which is a radical change in how art is used and what is being used to depict. Well, lately, I think it really started happening sometime around the Jesus movement in the 1970s and picking up with Christian music and then moving on into other Christian fields and into the 80s and 90s and so forth, Christians began to recognize we're losing our culture.
Yeah.
We need to find a way to get our culture back. So how can we do this? And so they began making inroads into culture, first with Christian rock music, which in its beginning, its infancy, was pretty bad. And now it's come into its own, and it actually is quite good and can compete with anything that's out there.
Yeah, and it attracts a certain group, attracts the younger people, which the churches were starting to lose.
Yes, and so that's been something huge as,
mm-hmm.
as the older generations died off, because they say the church is always a generation behind.
Yeah.
So as the older generations began dying off and they lost their ability to control how things were being done, and their own children were running off and,
mm-hmm.
and not coming back, people began realizing we really have a serious problem here. And so they began trying to recover the next generation. And as we're opening up to music, it's also starting to say, well, hey, there's more things we're interested in besides music. Yeah. We like film.
Mm-hmm.
So film is one of the areas that's just now beginning to see inroads made. And I think film is going to go the same direction the Christian fiction went, although I think it'll do it faster.
Mm-hmm.
When Christian fiction first started coming back and they started publishing fiction for Christians, people were initially, well, can Christians do that? Which is ridiculous because we've been doing it. I mean, C.S. Lewis wrote his Chronicles of Narnia and his Space Trilogy and other wonderful books, which are very deep and very powerful, a long time ago, you know. But in our generation, we didn't really have anything like that until Frank Peretti came along. And then suddenly here's this action-adventure story about angels and demons, and everybody went nuts. And then, of course, that was followed, you know, several years later by the Left Behind series. And again, you saw that same kind of dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So Christian writers began to say, we want to make inroads into this field and express ourselves in our writing and be Christians while we write. But we don't want to necessarily be shackled by people who say you have to avoid this, or the, you know, this list of banned words or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not really what characterizes Christian fiction anyway. Christian fiction shouldn't be characterized by the absence of sin per se, but rather by the presence of Christ.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you were saying here, and it seems to me that it wasn't that long ago that when we related to Christian fiction, it was chick lit.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of romance. It was basically what women read.
And we'll be back more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Michael J. Scott, author of The Last Scroll. So, is Michael giving you some food for thought? Well, he sure is for me. Stay tuned because there is more to come. Now, it's, you know, there's more and more writers are coming out and they're writing Christian fiction that is geared towards men or, you know, men characters, and it's not the chick lit anymore.
Right.
But something with a lot of substance, and like you say, it's Christ-centered. It's not that, you know, they're not sinning or anything like that. It's just that there's that spiritual component under it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, like you say, it's almost comes to, you know, it's cyclical, isn't it?
It is cyclical.
It's cyclical.
It's exciting to see that the men's fiction is starting to come into it.
Yes, yes.
What that really signifies is that we're beginning to recognize that men need to be able to be men in the church again, that you don't want to take a man and turn him into a hairy woman.
Yes.
You know, that's not what a man's man is supposed to be, especially a Christian man. He's not supposed to be like that. And yet, because our culture, and this is really something that Christianity, I think, is actually starting to take the lead in, our culture lost its definition of masculinity with the strong focus on femininity and the feminist movement and the natural correction that needed to happen because it was oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went radicalized to the far side, you know, to one side, too far in one direction, to the point where now we're you know, telling men that they can't act like men anymore because somehow that's offensive. Men begin going around trying to figure out, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at television, if you look at sitcoms, every man on a sitcom is an idiot, he's a buffoon. You know, you go from, you know, the characterization of, say, I Love Lucy, where Desi Arnaz is the intelligent one, Lucille Ball is she's the kind of loopy one.
The loopy one.
But then you switch it around to, say, something like Married with Children, where they're all crazy. You know, The Simpsons were Homer's a flaming idiot.
Yeah.
And that really hasn't come away from that.
Yeah.
So men are starting to say, well, wait a minute, we're not buffoons. We're not idiots. We're hard. We have passion. We care about things. We do go into combat and we do fight wars. What do you have for us? And for the longest time, all that was available was men's fiction in the secular world. But as Christianity starts saying, well, we need to make inroads here, you're starting to see more of an emphasis on how to be a good man and a godly man, but a man's man at the same time.
Well, I think that also, you know, there's, at least in Texas, I'm not sure if other states have these, but there is a Christian-based church called the Cowboy Church.
Yes,
and
I've heard of it.
You've heard of it?
I have heard of it, yes.
Yeah, and this is like, it's mostly men, and they're like cowboys. They're the bubbas. They're
sawdust on the floor.
Exactly. You know, and you drive past, and it's like a lot of trucks with guns in the back and, you know, horns of some sort. But they have this Christian-based church, and from my understanding that they have music, and, you know, it's geared towards the man. And so it kind of goes into the same type of line as what you're talking about. There's a place for them, and it seems that the men are coming and getting their own sort of place in Christianity, which is good to see. Now, you use this. This is, of course, a Christian-based book that you have written, and there are some underlying spiritual opportunities for the readers to have transformations or changes, and I'd like you to talk about that, how actually, you know, using fiction or stories can bring about change.
Oh, I think fiction has tremendous power to bring about change. I mean, if you think about it, Jesus himself told fiction. He told parables, and these were small little stories that he, maybe he made up on the spot, maybe he thought about them ahead of time, we don't really know, but he told these stories, and he used them to communicate truth. Now, the parables are true in the sense that they're communicating something meaningful and real and deep that we need to know about the world that we inhabit and about ourselves and about God. And yet they're fiction in the sense that, you know, we don't actually think that the sower went out to sow and that the birds landed and came out of the path and all this. I mean, maybe that's happened, but maybe it didn't. He wasn't describing an event that occurred. He was making up a story.
Sorry. Yeah.
And he did so to communicate truth and to get beneath the barriers that are there to people's, to the truth. You know, people set up barriers. They don't like being preached at. They want someone to, but everybody's open to telling a story, to hearing a story. Jesus was able to tell stories to his enemies that really powerfully convicted them and frustrated them, but at the same time challenged them, with the result that after his resurrection and ascension, you know, as the church gets going, a lot of his former enemies, the Pharisees, were becoming Christians. So it did get in there, and it did make a big impact in their lives. And I think fiction has that power to communicate truths that might otherwise be missed by the preacher or by somebody who may or may not be willing to listen to a sermon.
Well, and a lot of times, too, as readers, we start relating to the characters in the books. And we seem to sort of, you know, side with the characters that maybe most reflect us or have the same feelings or issues or, you know, scenarios as we do. And so when, once we can relate to that particular character, then we take on that persona in a sense. So when the change happens in the character, we automatically, I believe, you know, just sort of in, through osmosis, get it too.
Yeah, there is that sense of connection and, and a bit of the catharsis and that identification. And as the character goes through the transformation, if the writer has done his job, the reader's going to be right there with him.
Exactly.
If they haven't done their job, then it's going to fall flat and it's not going to be believable and the book is likely to be put down. But I'm glad you said about identifying with the characters, because to me this is something that I found really, when I cut my teeth on Christian fiction, I found this to be lacking. I thought that the way people were being depicted was very unreal, because you had people who were, you know, your good people, you know, it was like an old spaghetti Western. All your bad guys wore black hats, all your good guys
right.
wore white hats. You know? All the Christians were good and perfect and never did anything wrong, and all everybody else was an evil scumbag. And it's like, this is not real.
Yeah.
And so one thing I've really tried to do is to humanize my bad guys and to dust up my good guys, to make sure that they're flawed, that they're not perfect, that they have insecurities and doubts and failings and sin, and that it's all very real, and that they're tempted, because I want people to, I want it to be real. And I want them to recognize that this is about a human struggle, and that even the bad guys still carry the seed of the Imago Dei within them. They're still human beings.
Exactly.
So we recognize that, you know, Christians aren't a breed apart. We're not different from the average person, you know, because we've become saved. We haven't become some kind of weird creature walking around on two legs. We're still human beings. But for the grace of God, there go I. And that's really designed to be the lesson, is to say, wow, in the same position, I could make those choices.
Yes, yes. I so agree. And that's what makes your book so great. And I really encourage listeners, as you know, we're talking to Michael J. Scott, and he has written the book, The Lost Scrolls. It's been an interesting conversation, hasn't it? So, as you know, as you've listened to him, he's very knowledgeable. And just think of it, that he transformed that knowledge that he has into his book. So, know that this is a really good book, and I really encourage you to check it out again. It's The Lost Scrolls by Michael J. Scott. Michael, your website address?
MichaelJScottBooks.com.
How easy is that? MichaelJScottBooks.com. Check it out. And I really do encourage you, especially if you have, you know, just a little desire for a mystery, thriller, some suspense, and with a little Christian base in it, I know you'll really enjoy it. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Irene.
This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.